Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, Governor Tony Evers says it will cost Wisconsin $541 million to fight COVID surge if there's no new federal aid. Evers gives legislators specific bills he wants passed, but Assembly Republicans have other ideas. State Supreme Court justices hear arguments over whether governors can only declare public health emergencies for 60 days without action by lawmakers. The court will also decide whether the governor legally issued a new mask-up order. After President Trump's campaign comes up with $3 million, the Elections Commission certifies a recount of votes for president in Milwaukee and Dane counties. Rewind, your week in review for November 20.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, as a number of COVID-19 positives, hospitalizations, and deaths rise, I want to summarize both the positions in terms of legislative priorities of Governor Evers and Assembly Republicans. But before we do that, a couple things just happened before we get into these two summaries of the positions of these two sides. Number one, yesterday, the executive director of the Wisconsin Hospital Association wrote a letter to the governor and legislative leaders warning of an imminent healthcare catastrophe in the state. As a number, as I said, of hospitalizations and deaths rise, there were 83 deaths yesterday, only 9 short of the record 92. So the director of the hospital associations called for all sides to put aside partisan differences and act on a COVID response package. Point one. Point two, Governor Evers, Senate Majority Leader-elect Devin Lemieux, and Speaker Voss met this morning, and the statement from the governor's spokesperson, productive meeting. We hope to meet again after Thanksgiving. And Speaker Voss said basically the same thing. JR, before we go in depth to the governor and Assembly Republicans, what was your take on the morning meeting, sir?
Well, the morning meeting is trying to move ahead from what was not a very good start earlier this week. Now, if you go back and look, Monday evening, Governor Evers' office shared with Robin Voss, Devin Lemieux, and their top aides a bill to basically extend some things that were done this spring. I mean, more or less. Plus, also had some placeholders for money to cover the costs of contact tracing and testing if the feds don't pick it up anymore, and also to create some new tax credits for small businesses. The next day, Robin Voss called the news conference to lay out the quote-unquote initiatives of Assembly Republicans. The governor's office got worried what he was trying to do, released its bill. Robin Voss went out and said, we don't have a bill. Here are our priorities, after getting beat up for months for not having a bill. And then right after Robin Voss said, here are the Assembly Republican priorities, Chris Capia, the new Senate president, basically said, well, we don't need that stuff.
Right.
It's not needed.
Yep.
So
yep.
It's not a great sign of how things are going so far with the new power structure in the Capitol.
Yes.
And not just for this bill, but for the next session.
Okay.
And I had almost anticipated that at the end of this meeting, the meeting this morning between the governor, Lemieux, and Voss, they would at least agree in a special session, but that's not happened. Okay. Now let's look in depth at what the governor has put on the table drafting 19 bills. Let's go down them pretty thoroughly because it's very, very important. First of all, the governor says, without a new federal CARES package, I need $541 million for the first quarter, January, February, of March, to cover the impact of COVID in Wisconsin. He wants to prohibit evictions and foreclosures. He wants to require insurers to cover telehealth services and costs. Pharmacists could extend more refills by 30 days, suspend the standardized testing of K-12 students, continue the current rule that you don't have to wait a week to cover jobless benefits, U of I unemployment insurance benefits, allow the Department of Workforce Development to relax work requirements, and allow Social Security disability recipients to qualify for U of I benefits. Now, I'm going to take an in-depth look, just some of the specific spending recommendations by the governor that total $541 million. We'll do it quickly. Testing, $58 million. Contact tracing, $36 million. Testing supplies and lab diagnostics, $255 million. Hospital system surge capacity support, $105 million. Infrastructure to prepare for vaccine distribution, $10 million, and a PR awareness campaign, $2 million, not listed, is $75 million that he wants to add to the We're All In Aid to Businesses program. JR, your take on the governor's package? He put it in writing.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One, notice there are no requests for new powers to restrict bars and restaurants, to restrict public gatherings, to require mask mandates. I asked the governor about that. He said it was pointless because Republican lawmakers won't agree to it. Also, his office had stressed that the spending in the bill for the contact tracing, the testing, they were placeholders in their minds as this discussion moves along. In case the federal government does not step up and provide additional aid to the states, this is the price tag, essentially, continuing testing and contact tracing at a level we've seen so far. So keep that in mind about that spending. It's not necessarily what they want to spend in state dollars. It's what they're saying they may have to spend if the federal government doesn't provide more money to the states.
Right. And that $541 million, I want to stress, is just for the first 3 months. So without any additional federal aid, potentially, and that's an important word, potentially, 541 times four, the whole calendar of 2021, $2 billion, but that's getting ahead of ourselves. Now, as JR alluded, Speaker Voss then convened a press conference with a new assembly leadership, and let's listen to part of what Speaker Voss said, please.
We wanted to offer new ideas, things that have not been done before, and offer positive policy ideas for us to be able to say, here are solutions that we think we can do better for Wisconsin. One of those that we want to focus on is really the need to increase the amount of contact tracing and the ability of folks to get rapid testing. We also would like to have a pilot program similar to what's being done in Minnesota, where they do more at-home testing, where you're not required in the same way to go to a testing location. We would like to double the number of contact tracers. One of the creative ideas we would like to do is to take unemployment insurance recipients who potentially don't have the ability to go back to their former job and see if they would have the ability to go and do contact tracing, do it for a limited amount of time and be paid for it in addition to the unemployment benefits that they deserve. We also would like to take students who are in medical school or studying public health and allow them to also become contact tracers for a semester, pay them so that we would have more folks on the ground to help deal with the pandemic, but also help educate those students going into the field and do it in a way that would allow them to get credit. So we know that the restrictions that are in place, put in forward by the CDC for guidelines, are the ones that we should all follow. We know that people should wear a mask, wash their hands, socially distance when able, and try to keep social distance or social gatherings to a minimum. But we also recognize that our economy has to continue. People have to keep working. And we want to ensure that that is able to happen over the course of the next few months as the vaccine is hopefully distributed and we begin to see a turnaround in our response as a nation to the virus.
Before I give JR a chance to comment on the Assembly, on the Assembly Republicans' goals, let's just repeat them because they're important. The Speaker Voss said they would like to double the number of contact tracers, better access to rapid testing, pilot a program to allow testing at home, changing the unemployment insurance system. And this package, introduced by Representative Mark Bourne and Senator Chris Cappinga, who JR alluded to, would give immunity from COVID-19 lawsuits to businesses, organizations, and school districts and local governments who have in place COVID-19 protocols. JR, thank you. Your reaction to the Assembly Republicans, not specific bills, but general goals.
Well, it was kind of confusing to people because it seemed like they were teeing up their bill, and it said they gave us a list of priorities. Now, a couple of things to note. Speaker Voss, who is a landlord, said he is not in favor of restricting evictions and that the governor wants to do. He also said he didn't think we needed to continue the one-week delay or the suspension of the one-week delay in collecting unemployment benefits because the economy is recovering, he said. But again, even as Robin Voss laid out these priorities for the Assembly Republican Caucus, Chris Cappinga came in and said, we don't need these things. And it's just a weird message because remember, Republicans spent the fall getting beat up for not doing anything about COVID-19, at least not since the bill passed in April. And now you have the new Senate president saying, well, we don't need to do anything else right now anyway, that it's not needed. And this is his argument that, you know, it's not really the government's place to do these things. So I don't know what this means for getting a bill done, because remember, you have a new structure in the Senate where you have Devin Lemmy, who is a Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald on his way out the door to go to Congress, and you have the number two person for the next session saying, we don't need this. How is that? Is that Chris speaking for the caucus or Chris speaking for himself? It's kind of not clear.
Well, okay, JR, I want to ask you this question. Speaker Voss said we could conceivably pass a COVID-19 response bill, which they haven't passed since mid-March, in December. Well, December would, as you alluded to, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, who's about to go to Washington, U.S. House in January, would be part of any December lame duck action. But here's my question. Is it significant that this morning's meeting, Governor Evers, incoming Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu, and Voss, and not Scott Fitzgerald?
Oh, well, Scott told me that he's basically Majority Leader in name only right now, that they're transitioning everything over to Devin Lemahieu. Lemahieu's in the process of staffing up. He's hired a new chief of staff who come on board December 1st. They're trying to get ready for the session, and Fitzgerald is trying to kind of help provide guidance on his way out the door. But yeah, it's now become the Devin Lemahieu show, for lack of a better term, in the making. It's not quite there yet, but he's basically the one leading the caucus right now.
Well, okay. Follow-up question. Lemahieu has to stay pretty closely coordinated with incoming Senate President Kapinga, correct?
Yeah, I mean, again,
I don't want to use the term short leash, but they've got to work closely, right?
One of the big things I heard about this week was after this whole episode was at some point the Senate Republican caucus has to have a unified message. And what is that message going to be? Is Kapinga the one delivering the message of the caucus again or speaking for himself? We haven't heard directly from Lemahieu. He has not issued a statement about this morning's meeting. Robin Voss did. The governor did as well. And this is one of the challenges of becoming a new leader for Devin Lemahieu. How do you lead that caucus going forward? How are you as a messenger going forward? And how can you keep that caucus on the same page? Remember, there are different factions of that caucus. It was split evenly in the first several votes over picking Devin as a leader or Senator Roger Roth from Appleton. The challenge now is how do you lead that caucus, different factions going forward, and get them on the same page?
Right. Okay, changing subjects, but moving it to the judicial branch, which will play a key role in how Wisconsin fights COVID-19. On Monday, 90-minute oral argument before the state Supreme Court on a challenge to the governor's executive public health emergency powers. Let's talk about that specifically. Jerry Fabik, a Waukesha County business executive and campaign contributor, sued to void back-to-back COVID-19 health emergency orders issued by Governor Evers. Evers, of course, had issued a face mask in enclosed areas, 25% occupancy limit for rooms and businesses, which would include, of course, bars and restaurants. Mr. Fabric's attorney said the state law puts a 60-day limit on the governor's powers to declare emergency without action by the legislature. The Department of Justice said this, the assistant attorney general, look, we had a very small number of positives and hospitalizations and deaths in March. We have a doubling of all those in September. This constitutes a different emergency in September than in March, as we'll soon hear. So this was a pretty important argument before the Supreme Court. Before we hear from some of the justices, JR, what was your take? You and I watched it.
The question, really the hardest case is this pandemic one single emergency or is it one threat, one occurrence, with the opportunity to declare multiple emergencies because of new issues that arise?
Yeah.
That is the key question, and Brian Hagedorn is probably the key vote, conservative on the court, who sided with the two liberals in May in the dissent over the Supreme Court ruling that struck down the extended state of home order. Now, of course, going from a 5-2 super majority to 4-3, Hagedorn seems a swing vote. A comment that he made during oral arguments is getting a lot of attention. He basically said that the legislature had clearly intended to have a limit on the powers of the governor, how long the governor can issue these health emergencies. What does that mean? You know, justice is sometimes asking questions. You know, you got to try to read the tea leaves, and it's tough to do. But is that a sign of what he believes? Because he also noted that local governments don't have a similar restriction of the 60-day window. Because remember, state law says a governor can declare a public health emergency for 60 days. After that, he or she needs a resolution of the legislature to extend that window to continue those powers. Hagedorn pointed out that locals don't have that same restriction under state law and suggested that the legislature intended to have some kind of limit there for the length of the governor's declaration. But again, the question is, this one occurrence, or is it a threat with multiple occurrences?
Right, which is why the following clip that you're about to hear is so important. You're going to hear Brian Hagedorn's two comments. First of all, you're going to hear the attorney for Mr. Fabik saying, look, if you had a COVID emergency in March, that is still, even though the numbers changed, that did not justify issuing a new order in based on September's higher numbers. Then you're going to hear the response from the Assistant Attorney General defending the governor's action. Then you're going to hear both quotes from Justice Hagedorn that JR just referred to, then a quote from Justice Rebecca Bradley, and then Justice Jill Karofsky, please.
Well, the governor cited to the rapid growth of the virus, which in our view, it does not make it a new emergency or allow him to extend his powers beyond the 60 days conferred in the statute. The virus grows, the test results will ebb and flow. That doesn't mean it changes into a new public health emergency if the underlying cause remains COVID-19.
There is simply no way for the courts to draw the one and done interpretation that Fabik suggests without conflicting with the unit of measurement that our legislature has chosen, because the legislature has said that the governor may issue a state of emergency order when he determines that an emergency arising from a disaster exists. And a disaster is statutorily defined as an occurrence. And so I think whether we're looking at emergency or at occurrence, both reflect an event, but one that may be one in a series of events. If, let's say, a foreign enemy declared war on the United States and Wisconsin was under the threat of an attack from that enemy in March, and a threat of an attack in September, I think we would all agree that emergency conditions exist in March and emergency conditions exist in September, even though those conditions are caused by the same enemy, and even though the war may not have ended in the middle. And the same is true here. The orders have not been, as Fabik suggests, simply static orders responding to the COVID-19 pandemic.
And here you have the local government that has the power to issue a state of emergency for such time as those conditions exist or are likely to exist. And then an explicit limitation of time period as it relates to the governor, which would, I mean, to me, I don't know how you read the statute and don't acknowledge that the emergency conditions can exist, but the governor's power to act via state of emergency, which is a fairly broad grant of emergency powers, rolling back administrative rules, priorities and contracts, doing whatever is reasonable and necessary to secure persons or property. Those are broad, extraordinary powers that it seems like the legislature wanted to only allow for a very short period of time when you compare those two statutes. I have a hard time with the argument that, you know, it leads to absurd results. It certainly handicaps the governor in terms of the way he may respond, but that's because the governor only has powers he's given by the legislature.
I don't understand how the 60-day limit in the statute would ever come into play if we accept the governor's interpretation of 323.10.
The legislature could convene. They could write a whole new statute, couldn't they?
They could do that.
So the legislature actually has a lot of power here, should they choose to use it.
Now, as I said, Mr. Fabik's challenge was broadly to the ability of governors to issue back-to-back public health emergency declarations on both the 25% occupancy limit and the masks. But there were two developments just on the mask this week that we have to highlight because it's such an important issue. First of all, the Supreme Court agreed to hear an appeal of a mask decision striking down the governor's mask order, and that decision was reached by the District 3 Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court issued an order saying, we will accept this, take jurisdiction over this. Secondly, the governor said, I am extending the mask order, which there's this legal cloud over because of the pending Supreme Court decision. I'm extending it till mid-January. So two developments on that. Now, let's hear the governor talk about the need for the mask order, and his chief legal counsel, Ryan Nielsen-Stoon, was asked about all the lawsuits. Please.
I warned last week that the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation estimates that if we continue on the path we're on, Wisconsin could see 5,000 deaths by the end of this calendar year. As of yesterday, we've now more than tripled our seven-day average, averaging more than 6,400 new positive cases per day. The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases has tripled. We now have more than 323,000 positive cases in Wisconsin. It's clear, based on where we're headed, we cannot afford to stop or have a gap in some of the only mitigation efforts we still have in place. So today, I'm announcing I'll be declaring a new state of emergency this week and extending our public health emergency until January of next year.
Are you guys expecting a legal challenge to this new emergency order? And if so, how do you plan to fight it? Thank you.
Well, I think this is Ryan Elston. I think every time we've issued an order, there's been folks who have tried to litigate it against it. And we had oral arguments earlier this week in a case that addresses the governor's ability to issue public health emergencies. I think that will provide clarity on the path forward rather than a new lawsuit.
I misspoke, and I want to thank JR for correcting me. District 3 Court of Appeals judge struck down the 25% occupancy. So the legality of the mask order in enclosed areas will be decided by the Supreme Court. JR, put your perspective on just the mask order, and do you see the Supreme Court then coming out with a decision that encompasses both executive powers over mask and 25% occupancy, please?
I'm sure there'll be separate decisions, but they will clarify what the governor's powers are. Again, with the mask mandate, we're all watching to see what Brian Hagedorn does. It's people kind of think it's maybe a good thing for the governor that the Supreme Court agreed to take that appeal in the third from the third district. Because remember, the third district, a circuit court judge had said, I'm not placing on hold the indoor public limits, indoor public gatherings. That was appealed to the third district. The third district said, actually, that should have been, we're putting that injunction back in place because the plaintiffs have shown a likelihood of success. They had not ruled on the merits yet. But when you say as a court, they've got a good chance to win, we're going to put it on hold, it kind of forecasts what your decision is going to be. The Supreme Court grabs that appeal and said, no, we're going to go ahead and take it and we'll figure it out. So that might be a good news to the governor. It's just, I don't know, because I'm not a lawyer and I hate pretty what judges are going to do. It's hard to know where they're going to come down with the May decision about the stay-at-home order. Will these decisions reshape that decision? Whatever they do will help clarify what's going on. Plus, two, remember, you have now this reconstituted court, 4-3, it will kind of be a firmer question because there was some kind of thought of, okay, now that Karofsky's replaced Daniel Kelly, a conservative, maybe there's a path to reverse that May decision. We'll see if the court will do that or if it's going to reinforce that decision and add more layers to it with these two cases.
Okay, now we're turning a page now from COVID in the courts to this fascinating developments right now. There's a recount going on in Dana and Milwaukee counties of the presidential, of the votes cast for president. Let's lay the groundwork in this way. The Trump campaign sent the state $3 million to cover the costs of recounts in just two counties, Dane and Milwaukee, which, let's see, the unofficial, those were the counties that provided a huge margin for the presumed president-elect, Democrat Joe Biden. So you have the Trump campaign ponying up $3 million to cover recounts in these two counties going on right now. WEDC had estimated the cost of a statewide recount at $7.9 million. Where we are now, the results of the canvass of all 72 counties gives Mr. Biden an unofficial lead of 20,600 votes, 0.6%. So the recount is going on, as I say, and let's quote a Trump campaign lawyer, James Troupas, former Dane County judge who did not seek re-election because he was appointed by Mr. Walker, on behalf of the Trump campaign. We will not stop fighting for transparency and integrity in our electoral processes to ensure that all Americans can trust the results of a free and fair election in Wisconsin and across the country. Okay, JR, now I'm going to go into your area of expertise. This six-hour Elections Commission meeting, the back and forth, and we're about to hear Thompson versus Knutson, but the issue here is how clerks processed absentee ballots. Can you explain that before we hear from these two commissioners, please? What's the issue there?
Sure. Look, the heart of the Trump campaign recount petition is a strategy aimed at disqualifying tens of thousands of votes that were cast by people who were following the advice of state and local election officials. Okay, let's break it down to three levels. Number one, you have people who voted early in person. When you vote early in person, you get an envelope that you sign. This is across the top. There's a certificate and an application. The affidavit on that envelope says you are requesting an absentee ballot formally, because the state law says you must formally request an absentee ballot in writing. The Guidance from the Elections Commission has said for quite some time that suffices. This morning, the Trump campaign argued in the recount that you must actually submit a separate written request for an absentee ballot separate from that envelope. It's not sufficient. They were rejected in Dane County. I'm sure they're going to be directed in Milwaukee County. They are going to go to court and argue those thousands of people voted that way should have their votes disqualified.
Okay.
Secondly, arguing that the Elections Commission advice that local clerks can basically fix missing information on the absentee ballot, mail-in absentee ballot envelopes, that is illegal advice and those ballots should be thrown out. What you have is, for example, is a witness signs your ballot, your envelope for your ballot, and forgets his or her zip code or to put the state down or this, you know, some piece, and the clerks are allowed to fill, under the advice from the Elections Commission, to fill that in. The campaign is saying that is not proper. Those ballots should be thrown out. Thirdly,
quickly, JR, we're running out of time. Go ahead.
People who are indefinitely confined, they're saying folks falsely claim that. And why I'm getting all this is because the heart of the argument for the Elections Commission was, one, if you have to have available every written application for absentee ballot available to check, and the commission said, hey, look, most requests for ballots now come in through this website, and it's not really a written, I mean, there's not like a paper trail. It's more like an email to the clerk and a log that shows the person who requested it. And two, we want to change a footnote that more reflects the advice the commission has given for at least 4 years, saying again that clerks can fill in information. Trump campaign objected, Republicans objected, and they did not make those changes to the recount manual.
Okay, now I do want to quote from Commissioners Thompson and Knutson, where Commissioner Thompson says, this is the way that our local clerks have been handling absentee ballots for 11 elections. And then the response from Knutson, yeah, but it's never been challenged before. Can we hear that clip, please?
The President of the United States signed that clerks in 72 counties acted illegally. They didn't act illegally. They did what they've done for 11 elections, fair and square. Okay, Donald Trump won that Super Bowl in 2016 using that set of rules. Now he lost the Super Bowl in 2020. Instead of manning up and say, I lost, now he says, all the clerks are illegal. I can't believe anybody was sitting here and give any credence to that clerks illegally altered absentee ballots all across the state. Come on, Dean.
I understand, just like Commissioner Thompson, that this has been in place for many elections. But here's the thing. It's never been challenged. There's been no complaint or any challenge to it up until today. Today, we are now in possession of a petition that constitutes a formal legal challenge to that guidance, a formal legal challenge to that practice. And you may not like the language and consider it to be unnecessarily inflammatory, but our recount statute requires that if the petitioner believes that something illegal happened, then that's the basis to ask for the recount. If the court rules in favor of that past practice, then clearly those are all going to be counted. And if the court rules some different way, then that could be a big difference.
I apologize, they are, but you only got about a minute for your stock picks because we've had so much news. Go.
Rising, WJFW up in Rhinelander, real quick. The Trump campaign sued this small TV station in northern Wisconsin, along with the CNN, New York Times, part of an effort to kind of bully the media. A week ago, the Trump campaign agreed to drop the lawsuit. That agreement came 4 days after the TV station said, hey, look, you lost. Therefore, there's no more standing for you to sue us. So the little guy gets a bully to back down.
Next.
Daniel Kelly, hearing that he's looking at running for appeals court. Now, that's kind of a step down for a former Supreme Court justice. Remember, though, he's appointed the court by Scott Walker, lost his bid for a full tenure term this spring. It would, though, be maybe a step toward getting back to the court, because you're talking now, no guarantee he's going to win, but it's a conservative leading district. He would be running against an appointee of Tony Evers, and he could then use that as a springboard to run for court again someday down the line.
Falling.
The Elections Commission, having sat through that 6-hour hearing, not the first time I've watched that commission be dysfunctional. Look, it was set up to fail. Republicans created this commission to replace the old Government Accountability Board. They told us that by having a 3-3 partisan split, it would encourage compromise. It has not. It has encouraged deadlock. And Republicans will tell you they're okay with that because they, one, don't trust the structure because of what happened with the GAB, the John Doe investigation. They also don't trust the staff because there's still a lot of holdovers from the old Government Accountability Board, and they don't trust government bureaucrats in general. So it is dysfunction created by almost, it's almost like it was created to be like this way. However, it can't get big things done, and there are big issues to be addressed in Wisconsin about how it does its elections. The next step is for maybe the governor, Robin Voss and Devin Levy, to craft some kind of compromise. But after what you watched this past week on the COVID bill, you have to wonder, can these sides get together and address these issues and make Wisconsin elections run more smoothly? Because the Elections Commission is not going to be able to do that with what the way it's built right now.
That's a good call. Okay. As we end, JR and I wish you and your family a safe and happy Thanksgiving. We'll be back. We're going to take next Friday off. We will be back on December 4. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm JR Ross.
That's Rewind for November 20.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.